You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.
For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster.
Oh yeah! Welcome back to another thrilling episode of the Toil of Hell Radio Show. I'm Joe Thrashenkill. With me, I've got the number one good and golden boy, 365 Days of Horror, or as we'll call him throughout the rest of the show, Jordan. How you doing, Jordan?
Doing okay. I kind of can't believe that October is more than halfway over already. It just seems like everyone was worrying about, oh no, Halloween's going to be canceled. And now, like, Halloween is in a couple of weeks, so I'm kind of already dealing with Halloween being past us, but luckily we have someone on the show right now who is literally the real queen of horror. People might know her from her YouTube channel. People might know her from the Bloody Disgusting podcast. They might know her from her Twitter account, and she is everyone's best friend in horror, Zena Dixon. How's it going, Zena?
Oh my gosh, that intro. Thank you. Hi.
I've done my research.
Oh, I love it. You make me sound super cool and awesome. I appreciate it.
Well,
we got to build you up.
Yeah. You've got probably the most accomplished horror resume of anybody that we've talked to during our October Spooktacular. For the most part, we just talked to extremely crusty metal dudes. We're so pleased to have you on today. We're going to get into it in a little bit, the movie that you picked out. Would you mind just telling us, what is it? What is it that we all surely did our homework and watched before we came to listen to this episode?
So the movie that we're going to be talking about, Mausoleum from 1983. It is a supernatural horror movie, and it's directed by Michael Dugan. And, if you love possession, demon, wacky, bizarre movies, you may enjoy this one.
There are some particularly interesting things on screen and off screen with this one that I can't wait to get into. But before we do all that, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your show. I was listening to the Bloody Disgusting podcast earlier when I was driving around to get some donuts. What can you tell us about this show that you do?
Oh, okay, but wait. What kind of donuts were you picking up?
Shipley's. So, you know, for all the Texans that listen, Shipley's is an institution. I always got to go for a maple donut. Then my wife likes the cinnamon twist. Those are the essentials. And then, you know, whatever else surprised me.
Okay. All right. That's the snacky in me. I love donuts. Well, the Bloody Disgusting podcast, it's a weekly podcast where we discuss the weekly horror news. I also offer up some movie recommendations because, you know, it could be super hard with everything that's streaming. And I don't know about you guys, but it's I have a list that just keeps on growing every day, you know, of movies or shows I want to check out. So we kind of just try to pinpoint it and make it easier for you guys. I'll let you know which movies are coming out, old or new.
That's helpful. When I load up Shudder, I'm overwhelmed, and I sometimes just want to know which one of these things is a real movie and which one is just some rubber suits and just made on a nickel.
It really is a crapshoot when it comes to, I feel, horror more than any other genre, of what can be good or even a hidden gem and just what is just terrible. And I feel like that doesn't happen in other genres as much.
It's true. It's I recently started really watching this streaming service a couple of months ago called Midnight Pulp. And there are just so many movies I've never heard of before, right? And a lot of foreign or obscure type of movies. And you know how it is. It's kind of back in the video store type of days, you watch stuff based on like the movie cover. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not, you know. And then obviously it's not just only just with Midnight Pulp, you know, you with all the streaming services, sometimes you come across something that you think that you may enjoy. And sometimes it's so awesome when you find those, you know, those hidden gems that you really love. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I mean, with your example of the video store, thinking back to the early 90s, I've been kind of on a mission my adult life trying to find what those movies were so I can check them out. You know,
yes.
Sometimes it's great. You know, the cover art for Night of the Demons 2 stuck with me for 20 years. I finally saw it. I loved it.
Oh,
and then
awesome.
sometimes it's Monkey Shines.
I've had the April Fool's Day poster stuck in my head for about 30 years.
Yes.
I've still not seen the movie yet, but it's just such a cool looking poster with the woman's back towards the viewer and her hair is braided down into a noose.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's something so striking about that art style that for that, I don't know, 15 year period, it's just, it makes me feel so warm and nostalgic.
Yes. Oh my God. I love that feeling.
So that's awesome. And you know, Jordan mentioned that, you've also, do a show on YouTube as well. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, sure. So I create kind of like YouTube videos where they're kind of like listicles. I really love lists. They're fun. They make me feel happy. I feel accomplished, you know, after getting through a list. But just because I've watched like a lot of horror movies, I feel like it's easy for me to keep track of it. So like just the other week, as an example, I did a list on like the top snitching zombies, right? Because I was binging through like zombie movies, you know, we all go through that phase sometimes where you just feel the need to watch a slasher or a psychological horror. But a couple of weeks ago, I was really feeling zombie movies. And then it just dawned on me like, oh my gosh, they're tattletales.
Wait,
you know,
what is a snitching zombie? What are they telling?
Okay. So a snitching zombie is basically one that tells on a human, like it lets its zombie friends know that there's food over here. So instead of them like attacking you one-on-one, they're going to like make some weird sound, you know, and it's just like, what are you doing? You know, instead of just attacking, right? Imagine we're in the zombie apocalypse, right? And then you come across this one zombie and you're like, yeah, I'm ready to fight, right? And obviously you're not going to use a gun or anything because you don't want it to be loud. You don't want to bring attention to yourself. So it's like, all right, I can take on this one, but then it makes a weird sound. And next thing you know, there's like five other zombies. There's no way you can survive. So, and that's what I've noticed with a couple of, you know, well, there's more than a couple with some zombie movies. There's a lot of those tattletales in them. So, you know, it's just weird lists like that. Or, I also did like the top five scariest Disney movies.
Disney, you know, movies can get scary.
Number one, was Fern Gully a Disney movie, or was that like a different outfit?
I think it was a Disney movie, actually.
That one scared the shit out of me as a kid.
I mean, you had really Fantasia too.
Oh yeah,
for sure.
What in your opinion was the scariest Disney movie?
Okay, so there's, hear me out, okay? Because I know it's gonna sound weird. I never liked Beauty and the Beast when I was a kid, you know, because first off, this young girl is left in like this dusty old castle with this hairy beast man who's always yelling at her. And then on top of that, he wants, oh, I want her to fall in love with me. And it's just like, what? Why are you yelling? Why are you so mean? Like, we know why, but imagine being in that situation. She doesn't have anyone to talk to but cups and teapots and... No, it's like, that's terrifying. I would lose my mind.
She's trapped in an abusive relationship, and the terror of that is manifesting into talking candles.
Yes, right? Like, I don't know. And I know it was supposed to be all fun, and obviously eventually they fall in love, and they're singing and dancing, and they try to cover it up. But no, I've always saw it ever since I was a child, like, no, I don't want to be that princess, you know?
So. It seems like it's a ripe story for a dark remake. Like, I know in the past few years we've had Scary Red Riding Hood and Sleepy right. Hollow and Snow White, but like the dark, scary version, they haven't really done that with Beauty and the Beast.
You're right. I can actually see that. And I think that the twist should be at the end, he like eats her, you know? Okay, that's horrible. But I don't know. I would watch it.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Put it out there. I'd like to. Let's go ahead and. I'm sure that Beauty and the Beast is in the public domain, which is why Disney made a story of it in the first place. We should start writing that one. I think that's our get rich quick scheme.
Oh my gosh, I could see it now.
We do have to talk about one of your other videos, though, and it's the sexiest rides in horror.
Yes.
I think you might have missed a very important sexy ride.
Oh my gosh, which one?
The Green Goblin truck from Maximum Overdrive.
Oh, yeah. That was a very sexy ride. Like, at first I was thinking about adding that on there, but I don't know. I didn't. I know, I'm horrible. I'm sorry.
When it comes to doing the YouTube videos, I know YouTube can sometimes be difficult with its advertising and just trying to reach an audience. I guess, how does that compare maybe to putting out content with, like, writing for your website or even doing the podcast? Do you kind of have to change around how you're going to approach things?
Yes, you do. So I try to, since I'm a visual person and I feel like other people are visual as well, I try to just give them like a snippet of the video that they may enjoy. And, you know, I don't want to like force people to like click on my video, watch it now. Like, if you want to watch it, you can. If you don't, it's cool, you know? So I kind of just do it more for fun. So like I'll just like post about it on Twitter, because I'm always on Twitter and on Instagram and Facebook and stuff. And, you know, sometimes it's just even about just like the conversation. A lot of people, they'll just like to share like some of their like top sexiest rides as an example, which I love hearing that, because there's always one that I miss, you know?
And then you just feel the pain of like, oh, how did I miss that one?
All the time. Like, I used to do like sometimes even honorable mentions, because it's just like, you know, it's, I feel bad if I leave one out, but you know, I can't include everything, but you know, it's definitely like a good conversation starter.
I think you have a better relationship with your readers than I do. I would write things to rebut their arguments before they could make them. But that's unrelated. It sounds fun. I'm excited to check out some more of your videos. And on YouTube, what can I search for?
Oh, you could just type in like Real Queen of Horror.
And Real Queen of Horror. There we go. Well, if it's all right with you guys, I am just raring to talk about Mausoleum.
Yes.
Okay, so 1983, supernatural horror film. There are some folks in this movie that may be familiar, maybe not familiar, but you will know, you will hear about them during this. Jordan, how should we even start to introduce this one?
Well, even before getting into the movie, I'm kind of curious, why did you pick this movie out of all the movies you could have picked, Zena?
Okay, so I actually watched this movie recently, like probably like a year or two ago. Because it was like one of those movies where I would always see the poster, and I liked the poster. It looked very 70s, you know? I thought it was going to be like a like an Italian type of horror movie.
Yeah, I definitely get that vibe looking at the poster, too.
Right?
It's, the colors and the stylization of it. People should definitely do a Google.
Oh, yeah. This art kicks ass.
It does. And, like, I don't know. I was just, like, attracted to the poster, so I checked it out, and I was pleasantly surprised. Like, from the start of the movie, I'm not gonna lie, I was already hooked, because there was something about the opening credits. And you know, sometimes when you're watching a movie and you just really love the vibe, you know, like, it's like, and they weren't doing anything out of the ordinary. It was just, you know, we were at a cemetery, they're showing a cemetery, and then there's just like this big red font, bold, you know, in your face, and, you know, this music, and I'm like, oh, okay, whatever, right? And then things, it just went in a different direction than I thought it was going to go in. It just kept me there from the start. So, I don't know, I kind of feel like this one is a, you know, an underrated, you know, gem, and I feel like it's kind of cool to watch, you know, even around like the spooky season.
Yeah, this one, I agree with you, especially about that intro. It kicks off hard. Like, there's no wasted time with this movie. And from that very first scene, like, there are so many cool effects and just a spectacular bit of gore. Like, you got it, you know, you're hooked into it.
Yes.
Interesting. Okay, I get it. and I'm supportive of it. I saw this for the first time just a couple of days ago. Jordan, when did you first catch this one?
I watched it about a week ago for the first time. I had never even heard of it, never seen it referenced. This was completely new to me. And I was happy that Xena recommended it because I kind of prefer 80s, late 70s, 80s, and even into the 90s horror. So this is kind of a nice refresher from some of the other things we've been watching recently. And I don't know, something about 80s horror is just much more appealing to me. And we can kind of get into how the movie's shot and just kind of even the lighting in some of the scenes and some of the costumes. It's all just a lot more appealing to me than a lot of modern horror in a way.
Fully, nice. Fully agreed on that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I told my wife that this is the movie we were watching. She's like, "Oh my god! Well, number one, you're gonna love it, and number two, like, did you know that this movie was funded by the mafia trying to run a money laundering scheme?" And I was like, "No, I did not know that." We can talk a little bit more about that later, but I think that is something that is notable going into this, that the producers of this film went by fake names because they were actually members of the Colombian mafia.
Isn't that insane and like over the top?
I wonder sometimes how many movies have been financed by similar methods.
Every Steven Seagal movie.
Yes, by the Ukrainian mafia, almost certainly.
And this movie was one of the video nasties in the UK.
Ah, yeah, one was blocked from release in the UK because they had that 1959 Obscene Publications Act. This is just an aside. I saw somebody post a fax that Robert Smith of The Cure had sent to his record label. He was in tour in America and New York, and he had asked for a big sack of movies that are illegal in the U.S. under that act.
That's awesome.
Robert Smith, number one cool guy. Getting back into it, Mausoleum. Let's go ahead and talk about this opening scene a little bit. As you mentioned, you know, we're in this graveyard. It's a bright sunny day, and there's that foreboding big block red text with the credits on it. It's very striking.
It is.
And in it you see a 10-year-old girl wearing a child's cape, I think as was in the style at the time. There with her aunt Cora. It's the funeral of this little girl's mother, and she's distraught about it and flees from her aunt across this cemetery while her aunt screams for her. What's the next thing that happens here?
I think it's kind of interesting just to have in a horror movie a scene in a graveyard that's in the middle of the day. Everything's yes. well lit. You can see everything.
The grass is lush.
Yeah, lots of color. And this girl's distraught and running across occasionally the same plot of land, but running into this big, spooky mausoleum that before she enters it appears to be on fire.
Yeah. So there are multiple effects that they're putting on the exterior of the mausoleum. It kind of changes shot to shot. At one point it is on fire. At other points, there's like just big blocks of dry ice. it's very odd, but I really dug it. I dug it a lot. So she, you know, against the urges of her aunt, she goes ahead and climbs in that there mausoleum. What's happening inside that thing?
Inside the mausoleum, there's thunder and lightning. It's suddenly looking like it's dark behind her, and there's a creepy green light. I think Typo Negative would be very happy with this coloring. That as she's walking further and further in, it's getting almost like an Italian horror movie with this kind of psychedelic, deeper colors. And she walks up to what appears to be, I guess, a coffin. Is that the best way to describe it? Or an altar?
Yeah, I think it's something like an altar. I don't know. What did you think it was, Xena?
Yeah, I think it's like an altar type of thing. Where, I don't know, a tomb? Does it have a word?
Tomb works. Inside a mausoleum, a thing.
Okay. I was like a real big fan of how like just the fog just came out of nowhere. It was just super thick and heavy, just going through the gates.
Absolutely. The fog, the neon green colors, like all of that was very, very cool looking. Now, at this point, is it, I think, a groundskeeper tries approaching in, right?
It was never really explained on who this person was. It was either a groundskeeper or someone protecting the mausoleum, as we'll kind of find out later on that that's kind of a thing, too. So either way, someone telling her she shouldn't be in there.
Yeah, so she looks up at him and hits him with the old green glowing eyes. and man, much credit to the actor that portrayed this hapless soul. He goes running out, does an incredible pratfall down a big row of stairs, keeps running, and then using very practical effects at the time with what appears to be like an M80 firecracker, his brain blows out of his head.
It couldn't have been pleasant for whatever squib they used.
Oh, no.
They did this effect because it really popped.
It yeah. did.
And that's the thing that I think I dislike about a lot of, not just modern horror, but modern action films. You're not willing to commit to those practical effects that might blow out at eardrum. So major props, within the first 2 minutes of the movie, you get a brain exploding out of some guy's head. So that I gave that, started off with 1 star.
And it's we do have to mention that as she was looking at the altar and coming under the influence of something, that the name in the mausoleum was Nemod, which is, spoiler alert, demon backwards.
Nilbog yeah. means goblin.
I was thinking Alucard is Dracula backwards, but yeah, both work.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and give my embarrassing confession on this one. I didn't catch it until they spelled it out for me.
Oh.
To my credit, well, I was drinking.
No, truth be told, like when I watched it the first time, I didn't catch it. It took a little bit.
Okay,
so.
Good. I'm glad I'm not alone on this one, because after it happened, I was like, damn it!
How could I miss it?
Yeah. Nemod. Nemod? Nomad. Nomad, that's the one, right?
Yeah.
It's tough on dyslexics with this one. So yeah, we got our man's brain explode, and we're going to go ahead and just transport 20 years in the future. We've got Aunt Cora, who is appointed the guardian of the 10-year-old girl, Susan, who's calling up their shrink. Who is this guy?
Yeah, Dr.
Sam. He's kind of like her shrink.
Yeah, a very cool, very 70s type dude who just, you know, smokes a pipe and is kind of condescending to the people he talks to. I don't know if you have that kind of guy anymore, but he was in every movie for a period of years. Cora is expressing concerns about Susan, who is now an adult and married, and the doctor calmly reassures her that you're simply hysterical. You worry about her every year on the anniversary of her mother's death, so you know it's fine. At which point we meet Susan and her husband Oliver. Now, can you like describe these people to me, please?
Okay, well, first I'll start with Oliver. Oliver is kind of nerdy, you know. He wears a lot of suits, and he always seems very concerned about his wife. I don't even know if they ever even say what he does, but he's always working. So she's always kind of like home alone a lot with the gardener for some reason.
Yeah, they have a swarthy Greek gardener, I think. And the couple themselves, like when I think about like what the 70s were like, even though this was an 83 movie, like that's just what I imagine. That's how everybody looked, right?
It is kind of a cliched, yuppie, West Coast kind of late 70s, early 80s pairing, I suppose. The husband has kind of the perm and the light colored suits, and Susan is a pretty stay-at-home wife.
She's got the feathered hair. It's explained later in the movie that she goes to the hair salon every single week. That's insane to me. Who does that?
That is insane. But, you know, she seems like a very well-put-together woman. Like, she's very fashionable. I've noticed that. She wears a lot of designer stuff. I was looking at her Gucci belt. Like, I don't know. I was just noticing those little things. She's just fabulous, though.
I was really into Oliver's look, especially at one point in the movie. He comes from a business meeting where he's got his shirt unbuttoned down to his belly button with like a leather members only jacket. It fucking rules.
Their house was something else. I just kept looking at the background whenever they had scenes in different rooms, just incredibly 70s, 80s scenes. I think at one point later on in the movie where Susan's talking with Dr. Simon, literally everything in the scene is brown or beige.
Oh, it's I love it. It's wonderful to me. And yeah, that house that they live in, like they are well to do. That's like a 3-story house, right?
It's a mansion, a legit mansion.
Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful. I don't know, you guys remember, was it like kind of like a lake where we kind of saw the house from afar? And
yeah.
It was kind of like a little hill. Oh my gosh, I'm going to live there.
I also want to drive the Bradley electric sports car with the gull wing doors that Oliver has.
I thought it was a DeLorean when we first saw it. I got excited.
I did too. In a later scene, it gets closer to it. I was like, holy shit, that's a Bradley. That's the electric car that General Motors killed. I think the one thing that I got from this couple, like in every scene that I saw them together, I expected there to just be a bowl of cocaine somewhere, like not too far out of reach.
It's very much a couple of their times.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. We meet Oliver and Susan all grown up. They decide to go out for dinner that night and for dancing, as you do. And they go to the disco, and you know, the disco has a live band playing disco music, which was a thing that did happen, and you know, it blows my mind. That must have been a lot of fun.
This was another location where it's super late 70s, early 80s. Like,
yes.
I don't know if you've ever gone out really in the past 15 years and seen places that still look like it. Like, they still have the leather booths that are like dark brown and just kind of weird red lamp lighting. It's such a throwback to how things used to look, and really nothing looks like that anymore unless they haven't changed in 40 years.
I can't say I've ever been to a club where you got like your own table and waitress, and maybe that's like I'm just a pretty low rent dude, but I don't know if that's still a thing.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I was kind of like distracted with the music because it just was kind of terrible. You know,
and loud.
Yeah, people just looked like they were having a good time though. So I guess that's what people would do back then. So sure.
Yeah. We find this another incredibly cool looking 70s dude who is being berated by his date because he can't keep his eyes off of Susan. And man, just I the thing about this era, and you know, I've got a bunch of baseball cards from around this time, is you can never tell if one of these guys is either 22 or 44. There is no in between.
A lot of good facial hair from the era.
Oh, so good. Can you describe the lout at the club?
So this big hulking shaggy dog of a man who can't keep his eyes off Susan waits until Oliver gets a call at the restaurant, which again is a throwback thing that probably never happens anymore. He gets a business call and talks about business, and while she is dancing on the dance floor, this hulking man tries to drunkenly make his move on her. And does she slap him?
I believe she slaps him.
Yeah.
He gets a little too fresh and she slaps him and walks away from him, finds Oliver, and they leave.
Yeah. You know, Oliver has got to go do more business because he got a call from the business people at the club, as business people do. So it's time to go anyway. They go out to get their car valeted, which, again, I can't hammer home enough how wealthy these people are. our drunk man, you know, he's decided, well, nobody wants me here, so I'm going to go drive drunk as hell back home. Again, as you would do in the 70s and 80s. He gets in his car, our big oaf of a drunken man, and keeps turning the keys, and look over, and Susan's eyes are again glowing that neon green as this oaf of a man's car engulfs in flames.
Yep.
Very, very cool, unexpected bit for me right here. That one caught me off guard, and I really dug it. Just immediately getting retribution on this fella.
Same. I was like very surprised when he just burst into flames instantly, and you know, Oliver didn't really seem to notice or cared.
No, Oliver is pretty. He's a pretty chill dude.
He's focused on business and business-related things, and a car being on fire and a man burning to death has nothing to do with business.
Yeah, I mean, you got to keep your mind on your money, I guess.
True. So
they just watched a man roast to death, and, well, okay, it's time to go home, I guess. The next day, Oliver, totally unbothered by this stuff, he's like, I guess I got to go to New York for business, you know. Gonna do some more business. You're fine here, right? You're not traumatized by watching a man burn to death. He's out the door, and at this point we get another look at a guy that's kind of been on the periphery for most of this movie. Zena, what can you tell us about Ben?
Ben is the sleazy gardener who likes to show his belly. And, you know, what's crazy is the fact that he's just so bold. Like, I've never in my life seen something like that before. Like, he was just very aggressive towards her, you know? And the fact that she was kind of, like, entertaining him, that's how you know. Like, I mean, I guess she was going through some type of, like, mood swing. Clearly, you know?
Yeah.
Clearly going through some type of mood swing, demonic mood swings, you know? But, yeah, he's just, like, this really gross landscaper gardener guy who works for them, and he wants a cup of coffee.
Yeah, moments before he's asking for that cup of coffee, you see him erotically touching his belly button. as you do,
is the best way to describe this character.
I was incredibly compelled by this character. Just a total dirtbag in a way that horror movies really can only nail. So he asks her for a cup of coffee since, you know, Oliver's out. He's going to go ahead and try to make a move here. And at first she's, you know, like, hey, you know, get back to work. By the way, the work that Ben was doing here is appears to be spending days trying to remove a stump with a hand axe. And I don't know if anybody out there has ever done any kind of groundskeeping work. You're never going to get that stump removed that way, buddy. later on she goes upstairs, overlooks Ben hacking away at that little stump, and exposes herself to him, which I'm sure if the scene had extended you could see smoke shooting out of Ben's ears, perhaps his tongue rolling down the stump
like a cartoon wolf.
Exactly. Perhaps an awooga there.
And this is where she starts showing some of her, like, more supernatural powers, too, because doors and windows start closing on their own, and it starts to freak Ben out.
It freaks him out, but not enough.
Not enough.
Right, right.
Not enough to stop him from being greasy Ben.
So at the end of the working day, she comes out to Ben and is like, you know, we're going to do it. Or something like that.
In the garage.
Yeah, in the garage, as you do. We go to a scene of them post-coitus, and I think Ben's little monologue here is one of my favorite things in the movie, where he's just like, I've had some chicks in my time.
Yeah. Like monologue about it, like, okay, like
he's practiced it in the mirror.
Yeah. Yeah, this soliloquy, like it's coming from his soul.
They somehow managed to make him even creepier.
Yes. Absolutely. Just this swarthy Greek man that is, you know, a total pervert, just, you know, continuing on his way. So he's like, let's go ahead and do it again, baby. Susan summons up her demonic powers and murders him with a hand rake. My immediate thought seeing that happen was like, who's gonna take care of all your plants and stuff now?
Right?
You're on a really palatial estate. There's plants everywhere. Like, you had a full-time staff doing this. Like, I don't know if you've got what it takes to take care of all this work.
And then on top of that, okay, he probably works for a company. I mean, I think that they're gonna, you know, be wondering, like, hey, where's Ben? Where's their worker? Right? And who's gonna clean up the body? Like, I know later we see the body.
Yeah,
kind of. But it's like kind of like, okay, how did it get up there? Who's gonna clean this up? You know, it just looks very messy.
Absolutely,
Susan's very much in the now. She's not planning for tomorrow.
Yeah, I've never been that way. I don't think I could. I don't think I could ever murder somebody simply because I would be so worried about, you know, how would you clean this up? How would you continue on with what they were doing? This is no good. You can't do it. I've lost my train of thought. Jordan, where do we go from here?
So after that, the next day, Aunt Cora arrives at the house, and Susan's going to be signing for her inheritance because she is now 30, the same age as when her mother had died. And as Aunt Cora is going through the house with the paperwork, Susan suddenly is, like, changed into this demon. And when these changes happen and we kind of see Susan as becoming a monster, I got a lot of like Night of the Demons vibe from it. It's just kind of that same practical effect. You know, there's a person behind it, but they have different eye colors. They have different prosthetics on them. So I kind of like that subtle change. And later on we get away from it and it's not as good, but I guess when it comes to demons, especially in these earlier movies, like, do you think it's better to kind of have this look compared to like some other looks?
Yeah, now that you mention it, I do kind of see the similarities with Night of the Demons, with Susan kind of taking the place of Angela here, except being, you know, a yuppie instead of like a goth teen.
during this, Susan uses her powers to levitate Aunt Cora over a staircase, and then if I remember, she drops her.
She pulls her up out of her shoes in the levitation, which I thought was a funny little detail, and then splits her across the torso before dropping her. I wasn't quite sure how they did the torso splitting effect, but I thought that was pretty neat.
You know, I like that part as well. I thought it was pretty cool, but it's just like, you know, Aunt Cora, like, she didn't do anything. Like, I didn't understand why, you know, Susan or Demon Susan did that. And I don't know if you guys know this, but the actress who played Aunt Cora, it was her final role because she committed suicide.
Oh, no. I did not know about that.
Yeah, and it was just weird because it's just like, okay, this is the woman that took you in, and then this is what you decide to do. Like, I mean, you could have just dropped her then. Like, and then how did she slide out of her shoes just so easily? I don't know. It was funny, but then it was just kind of like, I also had like a lot of questions.
Yeah, you do bring up a good point. This is the first demon killing in the movie where someone didn't do something wrong. They weren't a bad person. And I kind of interpret it as this wasn't Susan who was in control of the demon. This was the demon in control of Susan. And she was getting rid of Cora because this is kind of harkening back to when her mother passed away. Like, maybe because she's 30 years old, the demon won't have power anymore. So this is kind of knocking Aunt Cora out of the way, getting rid of any inheritance, anything moving forward, because the demon's now taking over.
Oh, true, true.
So, again, when people disappear, nobody really brings it up. When Ben disappeared, I think that Susan told Oliver, like, she let him go home early for the day or whatever. But Cora doesn't really come up again. Oliver comes back home. They go to bed. He wakes up in the middle of the night and sees Susan partially transformed, just aggressively rocking back and forth in a chair in their bedroom. So he kind of flips a little bit. He runs out and goes to his incredibly sick bar in the basement and calls the doctor in the middle of the night to explain that something is wrong and that Dr. Andrews, you got to see my wife. You got to see her. Something's wrong. Susan interrupts him while he's on the call and causes him to destroy a bottle of what I assume is incredibly expensive liquor. Zena, what is the next place where this kind of movie goes from here?
So the next day is the morning, and the housekeeper, Elsie, her and Susie, Susan, they have like a conversation, right? Aren't they doing like the grocery list?
Yes.
Or is that a little bit later? Okay, yeah. So they're doing the grocery list, and with, you know, the character Elsie, I know that she's supposed to be like the comedic relief, and you know, she's not bad, but it's just kind of like she's so outrageous. Like, her lines are so over the top. Even the way that she talks to her boss, like, I don't know about you guys, but I can't. You can't talk to your employer like that.
It all felt really out of place compared to like the rest of the movie.
It did. And it was just kind of like, okay, because I know that she's a comedian, the actress, or she was a comedian. So I was like, oh, okay. I didn't even know that she was in the movie. And here I'm thinking that, you know, maybe she'll just say a couple of outrageous things, but this was the part that I knew that this is not like any other movie I've ever watched before in my life. Like, I knew that it was going to be like, It of course, it has like some serious parts, you know, which we've seen, but it also has like some over the top ridiculous parts. And I don't know, but yeah, this was just that scene where she's talking, they're going over a list.
Well, I just want to like call out that that actress LaWanda Page, like, has such an incredible like career. So it's like kind of strange that she was even in this movie, but I think she's most well known for playing Aunt Esther on Sanford and Son. But like before that, she came up with like Red Fox and Richard Pryor in the comedy scene, doing incredibly blue comedy.
The golden age of blue comedy.
Really. Oh yeah. So, you know, you can check out her discography, like the album Pipe Layin' Dan. And she, you know, for folks that came up around the same era that I did, you might recall her being the grandmother in Don't Be a Menace to South Central while drinking the juice in the hood.
Yeah, but that's also, I'm sorry, that's the part where, you know, she sees, well, because Oliver kind of gives her, Elsie, a warning, or kind of not really a warning, but just like he wants her to like keep an eye on her, make sure that she's good. And again, she's employed by them, and you know, he just asked her to make her like a cup of coffee, and she's like, well, we don't have any coffee. You know what I mean? And it's just like, okay, just, you don't have to do all that, you know? And then anyway, point is, Elsie, she sees like Susan's room, and it's glowing green, and you know, there's that mysterious fog again. And I love the fact that she's like talking out loud, because she knows that there's something strange going on. I mean, honestly, I wouldn't have checked anything out. I would have just left if I would have saw that green smoke.
She's just, yeah.
She needed to have a drink of the good stuff.
She's just seeing this and, you know, dropping one-liner after one-liner to herself.
And then she's one of the smartest characters in the movie because she just leaves.
Yep.
She got out the house.
She does. It's just the music that they play, that high-pitched music when she's running out of the house. Like, I mean, good for her, I guess. Like,
a lot of situations in horror movies would be solved if people just left.
Exactly. What's something that really gets on my nerves, and I love horror movies, love that, but something that really gets on my nerves is when stuff like, you know, that spooky stuff starts to happen and the family's like, okay, we're leaving tonight. Pack a bag. No, we don't need anything. Just leave. Just buy things, you know? And then obviously that's when people split up because they want to pack their whole lives and you know something horrible is going to happen. But if they skip that part and they all just leave together, oh, the car won't start. Let's walk in a group together, you know? Like, it'll be okay.
Yeah, a lot of them require people to not act like how people would normally act in situations like this.
I like Sinister a lot, just as a movie, but also because they kind of address that, like, okay, you need to leave the house. Leave the house, please. Fine, we'll leave the house. Ah, shit, it followed me.
Right.
Anyway, all of this stuff is a little bit off. Oliver convinces Susan to go see the doctor who puts her down for a hypnosis session, where she becomes a child, but then also becomes a demon at the same time. Our calm, cool, collected doctor is like, maybe something's not right here.
He's pretty nervous at the end of it. He's kind of stuttering and stammering over his words as he calls one of his colleagues to kind of explain what's happening and that he needs her help.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and the next little bit, I think I missed the 30 seconds leading up to the landscaper getting on the phone. Zena, what was going on here?
So this new landscaper, he comes to the door and he's rude, you know. But in his defense, you know, Susan was being kind of snippy too, and for some reason she's not wearing really a shirt. She's wearing a robe and her cleavage is all out, just ready to distract people. And so, you know, she invites him into the house. Well, not somehow. I mean, he clearly wanted to go inside the house. And yes, she kills him just simply like that. Like, and there's blood on the phone. And, you know, later on that night, once again, Oliver is just so oblivious.
The stupidest man in horror.
Yeah, like, he's just so oblivious to blood, like, on the phone. You know, and at first it's like he wants to, you know, talk to Susan about it and she's tired. But and we've all been there where we're like, hey, can we deal with it to, you know, the next day? But no, she's once again being rude to him. And it's just like, OK, you don't think there's anything wrong with the fact that your wife, who doesn't work, doesn't do anything all day. And she's exhausted from what?
Blood loss. Yeah, I mean, again, Oliver, like he's. He tried. he tried the most that he's tried all movie.
True, he did. He really tried this time. But once again, she won again because she went to bed, you know? And that was that.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's okay, though, because on the other side of town, you got our two egghead doctors that are reading a book about demonic possession. And in figuring out how to properly diagnose and treat demonic possession.
Yes.
Now, was this like Aunt Cora's family history book that they were reading through?
The Nomad family,
yeah.
I guess, family tree, family history.
I mean, the book itself seemed pretty straightforward with what they were reading there. apparently, all firstborn daughters of the Nomad family fall prey to a demon. So that's not good. But I mean, fortunately, you know, according to the next paragraph, like you can fix all this. You just need to place a crown of thorns upon them.
It's a very straightforward and helpful book.
Yeah, it seems like it could have been a pamphlet, maybe.
Right. And what I found insane is that it took Dr. Andrews all day to get to the mausoleum, you know, to get the crown.
Yeah. Wait, before we go to the mausoleum, there is one scene that I wanted to talk about right before that.
Okay.
We're going to the mall.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about this whole sequence. I guess it's just because I haven't been able to, like, be in a public place in a long time, and also malls don't really exist anymore, but... Man, I was super jealous of going out and hanging it to whatever the painting gallery / Spencer's Gifts that she went to.
Remember when galleries used to be a mall?
No, I don't actually. Like the Thomas Kincaid Gallery, if you can call it that.
That was kind of a thing. I remember at least growing up in central New Jersey, our mall definitely had, it was like a frame store / painting
store.
Oh,
yeah.
And I specifically remember on the wall, I don't think they ever sold it, was a painting of Kramer from Seinfeld.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. I don't know, man. Like, I liked the scene. due to being stuck in quarantine hell. It was like going out in public, shopping at Florsheim. Anyway, Susan's just going around braless the mall, looking at things. She finds a painting gallery. She says to the guy running the selling at the gallery, like, "Hey, I want that one." He's like, I can't sell you that one, lady. It's sold already, but I can give you a different one." And boy, this poor guy. what can you describe the sequence of events there, Zena?
So, for some reason, Susan, she's shopping that day, and she does look fabulous, you know, especially her Gucci belt. I've noticed it, and with her clutch. I know you guys are guys, and you probably don't care about that, but it looked great, okay? Anyway,
so we know Gucci. We know Gucci name.
Well, I was talking about more of the belt. It was just a really nice belt, though.
I didn't notice the belt. I thought the white blazer was a cool look, though.
Yeah, look at that. Okay, look at us. We're all fashionistas. So, she's at the mall for some reason alone, and she goes to this kind of like art gallery or art store. And she's looking at this painting, and the painting is kind of terrible. I'm sorry.
It's awful.
I don't see. Yeah, and it's all small. So it's like, all right, I don't know why she was so attracted to it. You know, I'm sure that there's some type of meaning to it, but okay, fine. Obviously, let's just blame the demonic possession. And so, like you were, you know, saying earlier, she was saying she wants this painting, and the poor, you know, guy who works there, you know, he's clearly stressed out at his job, and he's just telling her like, "Hey, I'm sorry, I can't sell it to you. It's not mine to sell." You know, and she doesn't understand. So then, you know, some woman, we hear another woman's voice, you know, another customer who's asking, "Oh, how much is this painting?" Right? And so the guy looks away for literally 10 seconds. Next thing you know, he looks back, you know, Susan's gone with the painting. So the guy, he runs out of the store and he's just yelling at her, like his voice is so cracky. And he's just like, "You know, you have to pay for that," you know, just screaming across the mall. Then once again, Susan's eyes just become green, and you know, she's just like levitating him, like over like stores, and then, you know, everybody's just screaming because, okay, clearly there's a levitating man, but no one seems to notice her green eyes, you know, like because she was standing directly across from him. That's just kind of weird, you know. And yeah, and then she pretty much drops him like multiple stories below, and then his body's just impaled by this sculpture, this weird looking sculpture thing that she was looking at earlier.
Yeah, it looks like he got dropped in the food court just with like a big stone spire on one of the tables.
It was horrible.
And I think that really this scene just illustrates that if you work in retail, it's not your responsibility to try to go after a shoplifter. That's your employer's job. Don't worry about that shit.
Yeah, you don't get paid enough to deal with that.
That's true.
I feel so bad for the poor gallery worker. Like, he looks so stressed out to be selling paintings in a mall, which is a job I didn't think would be stressful. But, you know, we all deal with different things.
This is one of those deaths in the movie where the character didn't deserve it, but I'm still kind of okay with it. He was pretty annoying.
His voice, like, the way he was just screaming and like, she was asking, like, okay, let me just say, no, I'm not that customer that would try to fight, you know, with a worker, like, "No, give me this." But it's just like, okay, rule 101, just keep your cool. Like, you could tell that he was just fed up with everybody, you know, but especially Susan when she was giving him some pushback.
Yeah, it's we've all had days like that working with the public, but the most important thing is, you know, just keep your cool, because you know, the customers will be bad regardless. It's okay.
That's true.
And one of them might be a demon.
Also possible. So it's around, or I guess it's around this time that does Susan fully make the transformation. What happens with her?
So she's taking a bubble bath.
That's right.
In this amazing bathroom.
It is a fabulous bathroom.
The tile work on that was incredible.
There's plants all around the bathtub. There's a painting right above it.
Truly, everything, you know, just the height of luxury circa 1983 in this movie. Yeah, she's taking a bath. Oliver drops by. Was he asking her to, like, maybe get help or something there?
In the kitchen, he was, like, just, like, before she was in, like, before she was taking a bath, they kind of got into some, well, from the night before when he wanted to talk to her and she was just yelling that she's tired, right? So then the next day, I guess it's, like, dinner, and he picks up his, like, you know, plate and bowl, and he's just, you know, trying to apologize, but he accidentally just, you know, try to, like, I think he accidentally bumped into her, and then she got upset, and she decided to just break a bowl or a dish or something. Then fast forward, she's taking a bath, and then, you know, Oliver, you know, he stops in, even though he tried to apologize earlier, and then once again, she's just a completely different person. You know, before she was breaking plates and yelling, and now she's in the bubble bath, and she's just being very nice to him, and he falls right into it, you know? And while they're doing that, you know, Dr. Andrews, he's on his way to get the crown.
That's right, yeah, he's uncovered this crown of thorns. Jordan, can you describe what happens to our poor Oliver here?
Poor Oliver does not make it to the end of the movie. Susan, who's now pretty much fully possessed by the demon, embraces him real, real tight. And I forget, does she cut his throat? I forget how she kills him exactly.
There is some kind of arterial spray.
And, yeah, so he gets it in the end and is a very bloody mess as he slowly sinks into the bubble bath, a look of horror permanently etched upon his face.
So I've never seen anything like, well, we kind of see something like this in Night of the Demons 2, but it was her boobs that killed him.
Truly incredible scene in cinematic history.
And what's weird about this movie is they do kind of, as Susan fully transforms into this spooky demon, that once again, they go to demon boobs.
Yeah.
Demon boobs that kind of change form throughout as well. They put a lot of work into those cities. It being fully, like, in the zone, in the demon zone, old Dr. Andrews finally shows up. He's got that there crown of thorns, and rather than dunking it on her head immediately while she's distracted, he decides to talk to her.
He is a psychiatrist or a therapist, so I guess I can kind of understand trying to talk her out of this instead of putting magical crown of thorns on her head.
It's still, you know, the same kind of zombie movie logic. It's, you know, don't talk about it, be about it.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. And at this point, she kind of reverts back into being a child as he's talking to her, trying to, I don't know, maybe the demon showing its full dominance over Susan at this point.
So, yeah, after an argument with the demon and with the... with the child version of Susan, he puts the crown of thorns on her, which banishes the demon to the mausoleum, right?
Yes.
So the pair, Andrews and Susan, they go to the mausoleum, the place where, you know, she's not supposed to go anymore. And the good doctor tells a groundskeeper, you can only see his back, to make sure that it's sealed. Do not let anyone ever go in there. And as they leave, our groundskeeper starts giving a hearty chuckle. who is the groundskeeper?
It's Ben.
Ben, the swarthy landscaping man.
Ben the pervert, who we saw die earlier in the movie.
And he laughs for like 3 minutes straight.
It's
like...
a good laugh.
It is a very good laugh.
What I kind of picked up at the end of this with Dr. Andrews, I got a lot of Dr. Loomis from Halloween vibes, kind of the caretaker of this person that's just mentally gone and is now a demon in quotes for Michael Myers, and is this killing machine, and the only person that can save them is this man of not necessarily science, but of like reason and thought, kind of trying to bring them back. It was curious if there was an actual connection between the movies or it's just a thing that happened.
That's an interesting thought. I don't know. I think that is a good trope, though, having an outside actor, your mental health professional, come in and take care of things when they become violent and murderous.
I mean, he's the only person in the movie who realizes there's a serious problem with Susan.
I do wonder, you know, of course, like what would happen to Susan after she's murdered her husband, her aunt, you know, various other perverts. Like, is that, I mean, are they just going to kind of cover that up, or like, will the law get involved at some point with that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking because she's rich that, you know, it'll just kind of, you know, cover up. But she'll just be fine.
That's probably the right way of looking at this. So,
Oliver went away on business and never came back.
Yeah. Oh, true.
I mean, he seemed kind of like he was a party boy. I mean, it's not inconceivable that he went away on business with his legitimate business partners to Costa Rica forever.
No one's going to miss Oliver. It's fine.
Yeah.
So that is the entirety of Mausoleum. I just wanted to maybe go around the table here and get some thoughts on this one. Zena, I mean, you just rewatched this again just recently. What's your final takeaway from this one?
I feel like this is just such, Mausoleum is such a memorable movie because in a way it just feels like it's two different movies. You know, on one hand, it could be very like moody, kind of intense with some of the things that's happening because you don't really know what's going on at first with the main character, Susan. But then on the other hand, it is, you know, cheesy. You know, I know that this movie, it isn't perfect, but it's like, I feel like if you're someone who loves kind of like Italian horror or honestly, like even like a modern kind of like Nicholas Winding Refn, like that director. Huh. Yeah,
I see it in the neons.
yeah, I think that he could totally remake this movie, because for the most part, yeah, it's dated, but I feel like there's like the practical like makeup effects, like the dialogue, it is like over the top and crazy, but it is a fun and gory movie, and you know, even though Susan, you don't really know what's going on with her again, and you kind of feel sorry for her character because in a way she's just a poor rich girl, you know, and she, I don't know if you, well, you guys know the whole saying with, you know, idle hands are the devil's playground. And I feel like, honestly, she wasn't doing anything. She didn't really have any friends. She didn't have a job. She didn't really have to take care of anything around the house. And I feel like even when it comes to like loneliness, you know, because she was an orphan when she was a kid, you know, and then, so she was probably always with her aunt and not too sure. We don't really see the relationship between her and Aunt Cora. But then even with her husband, like they seem to have chemistry, but for the most part, he's always away on business. So I think that she's just bored and I think that she's lonely. And, you know, because of her family background, you have like these the personality of her mother and, you know, that whole nomad thing is kind of passed down. So I kind of feel that, you know, even when it comes with loneliness as an example, like sometimes, you know, people, they'll turn to like drugs or drinking or something, you know? So in her case, I felt that she was just a lonely woman and now she's out there killing people. So, yeah.
I love doing these Halloween spooktacular shows because we'll watch some silly thing and one of our guests will come up and explain in much deeper detail, like some of the psychology behind what we've just seen in a way that is so much better than I'm sure anybody that was writing the movie had in mind. What do you think, Jordan?
You know, I think overall it's a fun and entertaining movie. You know, I think Zena's pretty much spot on with how I feel about it in that it's kind of almost two separate movies put into one. It does kind of get disjointed here and there. Like we've talked about some of the comedy stuff, which can be laugh out loud funny and genuinely entertaining, doesn't really fit with some of the scarier and more moody things that happen. I think something that really wasn't explored all that much, mostly because it's an 80s horror movie, that if they remade it now, I think they might do a little bit more of, is kind of exploring some of the trauma and emotional stuff that yes. Susan probably went through over the years. Because ultimately, this isn't Susan's fault. In other demonic movies, someone lights the black candle, someone reads from the book. People do these things to themselves, and this is all just hereditary. This is passed down to her. She's not in control, and other than Dr. Andrews, no one's even really helping her. You know, her, she has no friends. Her housekeeper left. Her husband's a big dumb idiot. So she's kind of in this situation alone by herself and needs the one person who's really cared for her. Like, even though there is Aunt Cora, there's, in the brief scenes that she's in, you don't get a lot of love between the two of them. And I mean, even little Susan runs away at the beginning. She doesn't want to live with Aunt Cora. So right. there's probably unexplored issues between them as well. And the only person that can save her is her mental health doctor.
Damn. Mm. Well,
said.
Yeah, that's incredible. See, because the entire time I was watching this movie, I was thinking about, mostly about like the mafia and their depictions of Oliver as a businessman, just what a mafia guy thinks that doing business is.
Answering phones and leaving.
Exactly. Wearing a cool suit and a cool car. I would like to bring up Oliver for a brief moment. Oliver portrayed by a fella named Marjo Gortner, which is an all-time name, Hall of Famer. This guy led an incredible life. Marjo, when he was 4 years old, became the first ordained Pentecostal preacher.
Whoa!
Yeah, so it apparently was something he got pushed into in the 40s by his parents. He was that good of a public speaker when he was a toddler. So he became like a celebrity evangelist back in the 50s. He kind of left it all behind in the 60s, and in 1972, he was a part of a Oscar-winning documentary about his life called Marjo, that kind of gave away the game of how shady some of these Pentecostal and evangelical preachers were and still are. he definitely has a this smiling preacher guy. Who is he, Jordan? I was just talking about him.
Austin.
Joel Austin. He has real Joel Austin vibes. And in the
which
years
I think now that we know that, might have worked even better in the movie if they kind of explored that a little bit instead of making Oliver just a businessman.
Exactly. Right. There's like a lot of rich material to work through there. But I mean, after that, he did everything. He put out rock and roll records. He was in a bunch of movies, including American Ninja 3. And he starred in what became Kojak. He was replaced by Celly Tavalas, but he could have been Kojak.
Missed opportunity for him.
Just big ups to Marjo Gortner. Not only do you have a great name, you've lived an incredibly interesting life.
So what did you think about the movie, Joe? What was your final verdict?
I thought the first half of this movie was outstanding, and I think I fell off a little bit in the middle when things started to get a little bit more disjointed. I was having a little bit more trouble following exactly what was going on, but overall, the practical effects, the actors, everybody in this film, I thought just played it to the bone. It was great at what they were doing, and I think this is something that, like you said, Jordan, almost certainly influenced a lot of schlocky favorites that we love, like Night of the Demons. And I think this one's definitely well worth an experience and a watch.
I still don't know what to make of the end, though, with Ben.
Me neither. I have no idea. Like,
why Ben out of everybody that she killed? Like, why wouldn't it have been, like, maybe Oliver?
Like, was Ben supposed to be the mausoleum keeper the entire time? Mm-hmm. Or, like, because she killed him, he is now forced into servitude for the demon for all time? It's just, oh, here's the guy, and he's laughing. So, I mean, at least he's having a good time.
Yeah, because, I mean, it could have been, maybe it could have been the lout that she murdered at the very beginning of the movie. Like, there were options for crypt keepers here. Also, the crypt keeper would have been pretty good. So I think that's where I'm at on this one. Well worth a watch. A lot of really fun moments and a lot of really gory deaths. So overall, you can't kind of miss with that thing, you know?
Yeah.
So what can we expect from you, Xena, in the next couple of weeks since we're now in full October Halloween mode? What do you have coming out soon?
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, more YouTube videos, continuing on with the Bloody Disgusting podcast on a weekly basis. And also, I was thinking about, sorry, I had to close my bottle cap. It was weird. Anyway, but also, I know with one of my favorite shows, like it's the season finale. So I'm actually doing a podcast with a friend where we're going to be talking about Lovecraft, like just the ending of the series.
Oh, okay. The HBO series?
Yes.
Right on.
Oh my gosh. I've been living for that series. I just love it so much.
Damn, you got a lot of work coming up.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's all about, you know, I try to plan accordingly. And, you know, honestly, I love it. Like, I would be doing it anyway. You know, I still watch the movies anyway and stuff. So, you know, why not just, you know, talk about it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Will things slow down after Halloween? Or is it just like, well, it's November, it's time to do Thanksgiving and other turkey things?
Yeah, that's, now it's just we're gonna switch gears, you know, for the season, for the holiday season. There's so many holiday movies to talk about and to watch. And then I know even with next month, there's this movie Freaky coming out. I really want to see that movie. So yeah, there's always some horrific things on the horizon. So no, you know, not slowing down yet.
I'm still so annoyed that I can't watch Saint Maud yet.
Oh my gosh, I know.
So was this the thing that you sent me, Joe, with the Red Lobster commercial?
No, that's Saint Maud is an A24 movie that they've been showing trailers for 2 years now, but they won't release because they want it to be in the theater, and it's killing me. The thing I sent you, it's. For the trailer.
I want to see if Xena knows this because I had never heard of this.
Okay, it's called Great Choice. The trailer for this short horror film appears to be a Red Lobster commercial from 1995.
No.
Okay. I saw this trailer 3 years ago, and I have been trying to find a way to watch this short horror film, and I cannot. The guy that made the movie refuses to release it online, so I guess you have to go to like a festival to see a screening of this. And it's so captivating to me. I want to know how they made a horror movie out of a Red Lobster commercial.
Yeah, I feel like we need to see that. I need to see that.
I'm going to create a petition, and you know, everybody listening to the show, I'm going to encourage you to sign that as well. In addition to checking out the Bloody Disgusting podcast. And checking out some of Xena's great short films on YouTube as well. I think that we're probably running out of time here. Is there anything else that we ought to tell the folks at home?
Well, thank you guys for having me on. And if again, like with this movie, with the movie Mausoleum, it is, I feel like it is underrated, but just know that it is also a little bit silly. But, you know, I recommend just going in with an open mind.
Absolutely. Going with an open mind, consider wearing a leisure suit while watching it. I think that will get you in the mood better. Jordan, anything else on this one?
Do business like Oliver. Absolutely. Be a businessman, go to business, see business, make money with business.
Xena, thanks so much for joining us today. I had a great time watching this and talking it over with you.
Oh man, thank you both so much. I appreciate the, you know, the invite, and I'm happy that you guys watched it. You know, I know it was a little out there, so I appreciate it.
I had a great time. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.